and welcome to yet another episode of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. And it is my privilege to introduce to you author, actor, composer, professor, and all-around swell kid, the man about whom famed journalist Edward R. Murrow once said, "Who?" Nick Santamaria.
Thank you. You know, it's nice to know. It's nice to know that Edward Murrow knew who was on first. I mean, it's a wonderful thing to know. Jerry, how are you?
I'm doing well, sir. How about you? I do want to throw a footnote in here that we are, in fact, recording this on Nick's birthday.
Okay.
You may or may not notice that I have a happy birthday sign behind me, but you know, I mean, that's neither here nor there.
You do have that, and I appreciate it. I really do. I am. This is quite a milestone. I never talked about my age, my real age, on Facebook. Mm-hmm. I always said I was like 105 years old or whatever, and I'm 65 today, and that is when society tells you that you're officially old. You're officially a senior citizen, but I say, ha. Ha, I say, in that direction. And that's with a lot of phlegm behind it.
I noticed. Yeah.
It really is. Ha. I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood, so I knew how to do the ha. But anyway, it's like, Mark Twain said it best. He said, "Age is a matter of mind. If you don't mind, it doesn't matter." So I go along with that, and I feel good, and people tell me I look younger than I actually am, and then I pet their seeing eye dogs, and I move along.
Excellent.
Yeah. So anyway, Jerry, we are here to discuss the third film of this wonderful burlesque team of Abbott and Costello. I know you watched the movie twice, actually, before we...
I did, yes.
We were doing
Couldn't
this,
get enough but, of it.
Oh, it's a great movie. I love it. And I watched it last night and made copious notes with my pen. And so I'm ready to discuss the hell out of this film.
Let's do it.
It's also Easter Sunday, by the way. And I just want to say this real quick. I hope this doesn't offend anyone, but I figure since this is about Christ rising, shouldn't it be happy Easter? Yeast-er? Okay, we're moving on.
Okay.
I still don't get what the hard-boiled eggs have to do with it, or the jelly beans and the rabbits and all this stuff. It's become very convoluted.
It really has.
I mean, can you figure that out?
No, and I have tried. I've tried innumerable times, especially raising a small child. That's an interesting conversation to get into.
Now, raising a child, does that take yeast as well?
It takes a lot of gumption, I'll say that. But cool. Some yeast.
Cool, because there's a sale on gumption at Publix. All right, so we're talking about the film In the Navy. This has a very fascinating beginning. Mm-hmm. If you remember last week on our last episode, we talked about the movie Buck Privates, which was the Universal's way of saying we have a new comedy team we're excited about and we're putting them in this film. It's a very prescient film because people were being drafted at that point a year before we joined the big war. What happened was they were all set to put Abbott and Costello into their next film. And it was a film that they filmed most of, and it was called Oh, Charlie. That eventually became Hold That Ghost. Now, that's the ghost, the haunted house, comedians in a haunted house is an old trope that, been done to death. And they figured, Abbott and Costello would be great for that. Lou Costello did a great scare take. Boy. And probably the best in the business. At least Mel Brooks said that. In fact, he was quoted as saying that. Universal looked at the fact that Buck Privates not only went through the roof, it went into the stratosphere, and it actually supported Universal for quite a while. seriously, I mean, they should have been kissing Abbott and Costello's feet because they were pretty much supporting the studio. but at that rate, they looked at the results of Buck Privates, the box office, and they said, we should play it safe here. Let's put Hold That Ghost, or Oh Charlie, as it was called, on hold, and let's do another service comedy because, you know, everybody's signing up now. Everybody's being drafted. Everybody's kind of getting that whole thing. The whole war thing is happening. So let's go to the Navy now and let's rehire the Andrew sisters because they were so popular in the last film. And you know what? We're going to up the ante a little bit by putting a big star right next to Abbott and Costello. That would be Dick Powell, who was a huge star at Warner Brothers. Not so much at this point, but we're going to discuss that. I have a lot to say about the co-stars here. I call them the Warner Brothers orphans because they were all let go by Warner Brothers and Universal picked them up. So yeah, we've got a lot to talk about here. So what they did is they put Abbott and Costello in the Navy. And the very first shot of the movie, which I love, you have a close-up of Lou's chubby little hands, you know, attaching a flag to a rope, which is going to be raised on the flagpole. And it turns out you hear a song from Buck Privates. You're a lucky fellow, Mr. Bum, 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 bum. And the flag goes up and it says Abbott and Costello in Buck Privates. And we immediately cut to Bud slapping Lou in the face and causing him to realize that he made a mistake. And then the real flag goes up and the movie proper begins. Interesting that it is Abbott and Costello and Dick Powell in the Navy. It reminds me of the same year, The Big Store with the Marx Brothers. They had to share with Tony Martin, right?
Tony Martin, yeah. It had totally escaped me that it was the same year, yes.
Absolutely, yeah. It was the year of the crooner. Yeah, so let's talk about this a little bit. I want to just mention that Dick Powell, at this point, big, big star. He was very dissatisfied. Warner Brothers started him out doing like the Busby Berkeley musicals. And he was right there at the right time because, you know, the people like that kind of singing, that, you know, very good at that. Did I just do that? A friend of mine loves Danny Kaye, and occasionally I'll call her and just go, you know, like he used to do. But anyway, so Dick Powell, towards the end of his Warner Brothers contract, was being put into one lesser film after another. They did not have the same gravitas as the Busby Berkeley musicals, and now they were sort of like cute little musicals that he sort of walked through. And he was pretty much through. By the end of the 1930s, he was not renewed. His contract was not renewed. And the same goes for two other co-stars in this film. One is Dick Foran, who was at Warner Brothers for years, playing secondary roles in A films and starring roles in B films, even had his own series of Westerns, B Westerns, which were really good, by the way. I have them on DVD, most of them. And the thing I love most about them is he sings. He's like, I think he sings before Gene Autry ever sang in cowboy movies. And part of the group of singers is usually Glenn Strange. Glenn Strange, who played the Frankenstein monster in several films, including Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. Wow. And went on to be the bartender in Gunsmoke for years and years. But he sang, and he has a good voice. It's really weird. I'm taking you into the depths, into the netherworld, the nether region of movie buffery.
Well, you know, that does bring up the fact that back in the day, when you were in the business, you pretty much had to do everything.
Like, I grew up idolizing vaudevillians, and specifically for that reason, because they could do anything. You know, you want to work, you learn how to do everything. And I did the same thing. Never really quite got good at dancing, but I can move, you know, definitely. But in fact, most landlords have asked me to.
So we're moving on.
So we have Dick Foran, who was in films like Petrified Forest. He played Bose. He was in Boy Meets Girl with James Cagney and Pat O'Brien. And again, he had his own starring series of Westerns. But now he finds himself at Universal, and which is an A-minus studio. Some thought of it as a B studio, but it wasn't. It was an A-minus studio. And Dick Foran is put into Westerns and Western serials and also starring in, you know, B-level musicals and stuff like that. He had a beautiful voice. Cowboy from New Jersey is what he was. I always liked Dick Foran. Always liked him. His last real hurrah was here at Universal. And by the mid-40s, he was done there and pretty much left to play supporting roles in films. I know that John Ford liked him. And then we're talking about the third orphan, who may be my favorite, Claire Dodd. Now, there's a name for you guys to look up if you want to, if you don't know about her. She was at Warner Brothers in the early 30s into the, you know, just past the mid 30s. And she always played the same role. She always played the other woman, and usually a bitchy other woman. She was the one that Joan Blondell kicks in the butt in Footlight Parade, telling her that as long as there are sidewalks, you've always got a job. I love Free Code, don't you? But she must have been, just like Dick Powell at this point, she must have been so sick of playing those roles over and over and over again and getting that reputation. And then you see her in this movie and she's a delight. She's she's got the 1940s style. She's sleek. She's pretty. She's got that beautiful cleft in her chin. She's adorable. And she's a great leading lady for Dick Powell in this. But she, again, after this little stint at Universal, she made a few movies at Columbia and all that stuff, but she kind of moved on. She got married, raised a family. My friend Scott Ratner is especially in love with her and actually got to know the family, got to know her son, and got to perform, I think, for them. He was a magician, and I think he did a party for them. But anyway, so that's Claire Dodd. She was another Warner Brothers orphan. I look at it this way. Back in the 30s, people were not especially thrilled to be cast in a Shirley Temple movie, right? You always played second fiddle. She was always the focus, but you did your best around her. And to be honest with you, when I was a kid, I usually watched for the supporting players, you know, Jack Oakey and Jack Haley and other Jacks. But I'm on my foursies. They weren't especially thrilled, but I could hear their agents saying, do you realize she's the most popular performer in film and everybody will see you because everybody goes to see her films? That was their agent, by the way. So I could hear Dick Powell's agent saying the same thing to him. You know, he could be saying, now I'm playing second fiddle to a burlesque team. Yeah, but everybody in the universe is going to see this film because of that burlesque team. So hop on their surfboard and take the ride, you know? But everything worked out for Dick Powell. These were his uncomfortable years. He was done at Warner Brothers. He was looking around. He made a couple of movies for MGM. Paramount signed him for some really mediocre musicals. And thank God he went over to RKO and did Murder, My Sweet and became a tough guy actor. He went from that goofy to beating up bad guys. And he was excellent. And he was Raymond Chandler's favorite Philip Marlowe. How about that?
Oh yeah, man. I love his the radio stuff he did at that time as well.
Definitely.
The detective shows that he did. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So good. He was terrific. He was terrific. And I love his noir films. His film noir, just terrific. And he does. He pulls it off. So way to go. Way to go, Mr. Powell. And he also became one of the biggest television moguls of the era of the 1950s and 60s. June Allison used to complain because he was all business. He was not a romantic. He was not someone who, you know, was light and airy. He was a businessman 24 hours a day. She once told him to leave. And this is like a year before he died of cancer. She said, get out. I don't want to see you anymore, blah, blah, blah. And he just ignored her. And he'd show up for breakfast every morning and stay and stick around. He just, as if she never said anything.
Okay.
But he died young. In fact, I think he died the same day that Jack Carson passed away. Two people too young to go and too talented to go.
Yeah.
All right. So back to in the Navy. So we know that they're pushing off Hold That Ghost, which we will be covering in our next episode. And so they're doing a follow-up, a real follow-up to Buck Privates. Now, I mentioned that I feel that this film is their first official Abbott and Costello movie. I can't look at One Night at the Tropics as their first, real film. Right? Right, Jerry? They were...
Yeah. Their support in that one, definitely.
Definitely. And you could argue that their next film, Buck Privates, which has some of their best routines, they are also comedy relief, and they have nothing to do with the plot. In the Navy is a different story. They're part of the story. They are the focus. Even their performances are better than they were in Buck Privates. Lou is nowhere near his radio character, which he used in Buck Privates occasionally. And he even did the I'm a bad boy, you know. But this is their first where they're actually Abbott and Costello, the movie Abbott and Costello. Just like Animal Crackers and Coconuts. I feel like Coconuts, the boys didn't have it yet. They just didn't have it yet. Animal Crackers, it all changed. They learned, right?
Yes, with Abbott and Costello,
this is their Animal Crackers. This is where they learned. And
you you have said in previous episodes, you've talked about Bud as an actor and how good he is as an actor. And I again, this is the first of their films where that really comes through.
He is so good in this movie. He's very good, Gary, because he really is good in this movie. And I have to say that the writers had something to do with that, because if you remember in the book, in my chapter, I mentioned that Bud actually is a real person in this. Yes. He's not someone attached to the little fat guy, you know, slapping him around and asking him impossible questions. At one point, he even goes up to Dick Powell and says, hey, you want to go out? You know, let's go out into town, you and I. And I'm like, wow, Bud doesn't do that. You know, if it's not around the Lou universe or the Looniverse, he's just not around, you know?
Yeah.
So not only does he have a private life in this one, and he buddies up with Dick Powell, one of the stars, he's also a very capable electrician, right? And he's also a very capable orchestra conductor.
Apparently.
Yeah, he has a history. He has a background. He has fully formed in 3D, you know?
Yep.
So I like that about this film. Their relationship is better. Their timing is better. Everything about it is just Abbott and Costello, you know? Mm-hmm. And don't get me wrong. I love Buck Privates. Don't start writing little comments. Oh, how can you not like Buck Privates? Bud thought it was their best film. But I have to disagree. I still think they had a 1 foot in radio and in comedy relief land.
Yeah.
So the movie begins that way, and we get the idea that this is interesting because it's almost autobiographical about Dick Powell. He is dissatisfied being the goofy crooner, Russ Raymond, and he wants to just go away from all of that and be a regular guy. He joins the Navy, changes his name to Tommy Halstead, and he just wants to be left alone. He even shaves his mustache. He starts out with a mustache.
You had to look twice to see it, though. It was really just one of those pencil thin. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's going to make a big difference.
Big difference. Yeah. It's like Clark Kent with the glasses, you know?
Yes.
Oh, my. I didn't recognize you. but I did want to mention before I forget that one of the ladies, and I use that term loosely, going to see Russ Raymond is Blanche Payson. Blanche Payson was the huge woman who was married to Oliver Hardy in Helpmates.
Helpmates.
Oh, she's terrifying in that movie. She's one of those people that was originally a matron in a woman's prison. And she's huge. She's bigger than any man in this film. And she's paired up with a guy by the name of Hal K. Dawson, who's a tiny actor. So the two of them made a very funny two-level effect act.
Yes.
So Russ Raymond hates being a crooner. The husbands all hate him. The wives all love him. I think they used every Universal starlet in that radio audience watching Russ Raymond. You know, there were some wonderful close-ups of these ladies just totally losing it for Russ Raymond. And he's saying, starlight, starlight, first star I see tonight. And it's a good song, actually. Songs, by the way, are Gene DePaul and Don Ray, who are really two of Universal's finest songwriters. They wrote some beautiful stuff. Okay, so Russ Raymond. Yes.
Yeah, before you move on, I did want to point out a marvelous texture piece that Dick Powell pulls off. As he's singing, they're in the radio studio and he's performing in the audience. As you say, they're all swooning in their chairs and he's singing this song and selling it nicely.
Yes.
But he takes a look at his watch as he's singing.
Yes.
Never loses a beat, never changes tone or inflection. But you know he would rather be anywhere else that moment.
And the women are just like, you know, they're having children as they watch him. it's really something. Well, there was no popcorn at the time.
Well, true.
So, yeah, that's very good. I noticed that also. And I love when he looks at the husband who's holding his nose while he's singing.
Yes.
And he gives him the okay, I understand, pal. Yeah. We're all in the same boat here. So you know that, you know, Dick Powell's a regular guy, just wants to be left alone and whatever, what have you. And, of course, you, the Navy responds and tells them that we will keep your secret and you're welcome to come. And they give that responsibility of delivering that letter to him to a couple of gobs who one is Bud's, what, 44 years old? He's a very old sailor, let's put it that way. And you really see how skinny Bud was at this point before the booze and the cigarettes took over. He was really, really thin. And little Lou, who is just like a little ball of energy in this movie, he's just hilarious.
Yes.
One of my favorite intros to them is the truck driver in the dump truck. You guys want to get off? And Bud says, yeah, drop us anywhere. And of course, the dump truck leaves them in the middle of the street where they cause havoc with every car on the road. And, you know, Lou yelling, oh, there's never a cop around when you need one. And of course, there's one right behind him. It has one of my favorite moments here is when they do a version of Go Ahead and Sing, you know, just like they did in Buck Price. Yes. Turn on the radio. It's give him a ticket. Right? Cop wants to give him a ticket for jaywalking. And Bud's like, yes, give him a ticket. Yeah, give him. What are you talking about? You know, it's the same thing, basically. But there's one point where, and this is what I love about this scene. There's one point where Dick Foran shows up and he's a military cop. So he's sort of the foil. You know, he's the one that gets in their hair. And Lou is complaining. And Dick Foran says to him, tell it to the Marines. And a Marine happens to walk by, and Lou turns around and says, you know what? I was crossing the street. And but it's just wonderful. It's just wonderful.
Yes.
Makes me laugh out loud. And then when they're walking and they stop to say hello to the little baby in the carriage, that's little Carol Costello. That's Lou's oldest daughter. Or second oldest? I forgot. Anyway, that's Lou's daughter, Carol. So, yeah, so they deliver the letter to Dick Powell. And this is another moment that I love. Lou is all excited because he, quite by accident, acquires a bankroll of money from Dick Foran, who loses it. And Lou tells Dick Powell that he's going to take it and buy every record the Andrews Sisters ever made. And then he starts singing, you're a lucky fellow, Mr. Smith, doing his own version of it. And it's hilarious. Watch Dick Powell's face while Lou is singing. It's absolutely precious. He is, he's just looking at him like, oh, you are so funny. It's really, really a nice moment. And it's very sincere, very sincere. And this is where we meet our intrepid photographer for the newspaper. She is dead set on getting a photograph of Russ Raymond because he disappeared. You know, he was stepping into anonymity. And which is right near Amityville, from what I understand.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Just to the left.
Just to the left, yeah, politically. So anyway, so she's there to do that, and she becomes a real nuisance, you know, until they fall in love, of course. But there is that moment where he's spanking her. And that is such a no-no nowadays, you know? It used to be a very innocent, kind of cute thing, you know, back in the old movies and TV shows. Now it's like, oh, look, he's abusing her. You know what? It's cute and it's kind of sexy. Okay? And you could take it. This is our podcast. We could say whatever we want. And when he slaps her little butt, that's just, okay. Yeah. About 1,000 people just turned off the podcast. So this is another thing I wanted to mention. The songs in this movie aren't quite up to the songs from Buck Rogers. They were not hits.
They are not.
But you got to admit, Slip Me Some Skin, my friend. It's as good as anything they did in Buck Private. I think so. Anyway, I think it's a great song. Also, Hula Baloo-ow. It's a Hula Baloo-ow. That one maybe stretches it a little bit. And they have the bongos on their hips.
Yes, that's when they lost me, when the Andrews Sisters entered and they got those bongos strapped to their hips and they start playing them around. Well, and then the first one, We're in the Navy, I think is the name of it.
Yeah, we're in the Navy.
It's the first song that they do in the movie, and you know what kind of a ride you're in for when one of the rhyme scheme, one of the lines is, wherever you're sent, you're set for adventure. Okay.
It works. It works. It's in the meat. It's in that same meter and rhythm.
Yeah.
I am a lyricist. I am a professional lyricist. And I give them a pass on that. But then again, maybe not. But it's not exactly, you know, a hit song. It's but it, you know, it serves its purpose. It's very patriotic and, you know, bouncy.
Oh, yeah.
And stuff. What I love is that in every one of Abbott and Costello's service comedies, and there was Buck Privates in the Navy and Keep 'Em Flying with the Army Air Force, every one of them has a speech by a colonel or whatever to the men. Men, you don't know me, and I don't know most of you, and even if I did, I wouldn't spit on you if you were on fire. I didn't say that. I just didn't, he was thinking it, but he wasn't saying it. But anyway, there's always that same speech. Another thing, Jerry, something yes. else to mull around. Do you realize how close, when this movie was put out and, you know, released, how close we were to Pearl Harbor? And you wonder that in this movie, they're all talking about going to Hawaii on their ships. We're going to be stationed there in Hawaii. I wonder if they made it. Seriously.
I never even made that connection. Yes.
Last night was the first time I thought about it as I was watching it. And I'm thinking, they're going to Pearl Harbor. They're going mm-hmm. to. And Bud and Lou, if they were there, man, it would have been different. Would have been different. Yeah. You know?
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I thought that was kind of fascinating because they had no idea. Of course they had no idea. But the very next few months, history was made. Let's just put it that mm-hmm. way. Mm-hmm. So Dick Powell is heading for the Navy. Bud and Lou are already there. Bud, how can I put this? Lou has a crush on Patty Andrews of the Andrews sisters, right?
And rightly so.
She's dynamite. And he has been writing to her, and she doesn't know what he looks like. But on Bud's advice, he has been telling her that he's tall and handsome and higher up in the Navy and all these lies.
Hello, Pommy, old boy.
You shut up.
Now,
the whole darn thing is your fault.
Now, don't get...
You told me to write to that girl and tell her I was 6'2". Didn't you say that?
All right, now, wait a minute.
And did you tell me to tell her that I had eyes of blue? You know I ain't got eyes of blue.
I know that.
And then you go ahead and tell her that I'm supposed to tell her that I'm an admiral in the Navy.
Right.
You know all I am is a baker of the White House. Well, rebel.
There's no harm done.
Smokey.
Oh.
You've not only wrecked my whole life, but you spoiled my whole day. Shame on you.
You hit me.
Shame on me, too.
You hit me.
Smokey, I must be losing my mind. I didn't mean to hit you, Smokey. Smokey, please believe me. I never lay my hands on you, Smokey, you know that. Smokey, hit me right in the face. Go ahead.
A lot of good that'll do.
Make up for that, Smokey. Hit me right in the face and make me happy. Go ahead, Smokey, hit me right there. And I had to coax him to do it.
And, when Patty actually sees him for the first time, she uses one of my favorite W.C. Fields lines from The Bank Dick. Is he standing in a hole? Because he was so little. He's tiny. And there's that wonderful scene where he's putting the guys through their paces in the rowboat. And they
yes.
keep hitting him with the oar. And I will have to say this before I forget. Shemp Howard in this movie has a
yes.
much better role than he did in Buck Privates. He's there.
Yes.
He's like the third banana in this movie. Yeah, because he's there. You know, it's like he's always
yep.
there. He's there for 7 times 13 equals 28. He's there mm-hmm. for the lemon bit. He's there for, you know, really a lot of it. So it's good to see Shemp get his due. And they both work beautifully with him, I must say.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, they start doing their bits. Let's put it that way. And they already did give him a ticket, which is kind of like, go ahead and sing.
Yeah.
But I'm looking at the lemon bit, okay?
Yes.
The lemon table bit, okay. This is one of Bud Abbott's very favorite bits to do. He'd been doing it for years with other partners in burlesque. And Lou had done it many, many times, I'm sure, with other people. But then did it on Broadway with Bud for, you know, over 100 performances.
Mm-hmm.
So they knew it. like the back of their hands. And if you watch Bud in this scene, you see why Bud was so valued as a straight man. He is just incredible. When Lou's off to the side doing the physical stuff, you know, putting the lemons underneath the cans and, you know, whatever he's doing with Shemp on the other side, Bud is keeping up. He's just keeping up that run of dialogue. You know, you don't even have to hear it, but he's doing it, you know?
Yeah, it keeps the energy of the scene going. And one thing I noticed this last time that I watched it, his dexterity with those cups.
Yep.
The way he shuffles them around at the speed that he does, you can tell he's done this a couple of times.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. And it's dazzling to watch. It really is.
Yes.
When Lou gets involved at the end, when he's stuffing the, as fast as Bud's moving, he's moving, stuffing the things under. And then, of course, it's the grapefruit at the end. But it has one of my favorite Bud lines that he doesn't do with Lou. The guy finds the lemon. And he says, and he takes his money and he goes, "What's the matter? Are you mad?" And Bud says, "Of course I'm mad." And he goes, "Well, here, suck on the lemon." I love that line. but I do have my problems with this bit. It's not my favorite. Okay. And I'll tell you why. I love watching them do it because of, like you say, the dexterity involved and just how wonderfully familiar it is to them. Mm-hmm. But I don't buy it. I don't buy it. There's that gaping hole in the table that I'm sure everybody sees, and it takes away from me. It's like, I know that's, you need that hole there because that's what the whole bit is about. You know, he puts the lemon under the cup. It's like three card Monty, you know?
Yes.
And as the cup goes past the hole in the table, of course it falls into a basket underneath the table. And of course, nobody could pick where the lemon is because it's not there. But why doesn't Lou see the hole and say, "Wait a minute, why is there a hole?" But again, I guess you can say, why is there a first baseman named Who, for crying out loud?
There is so that. Let me pose this this alternative to you then. If the table was equipped with a few holes, would that make a difference?
I don't know. I don't know. It's still very simplistic to me, you know, that there is a hole at all, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. I just don't. It bothers me. It bothers me that we have to believe the fact that they don't notice the hole in the table. You know what I mean? Yeah. And I just don't buy it. I just don't buy it. Funny stuff. You know, Lou's got some funny dialogue and some funny bits of business. And Shemp is really good in it. But I have to say that it's not my favorite. Not my favorite.
In this incarnation of the lemon bit, though, in this film, I do enjoy how they augment it. They stick some of the money exchange routines in the middle of it. And
The whole thing about how long have you been? How long have you been in the Navy? Yeah, 3 months. Three, four, five, six. Yeah, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. And of course, Lou can't do it. He's, he gets screwed over by himself, actually. He's just not mathematically good. He's just challenged that way. And then we got to really the first good song in the movie, and that's "Give Me Some Skin, My Friend."
There's only one way to show it. If you want to shake my hand like they do it in Harlem, stick your hand right out and shout, "Give me some skin, my friend." Step right up and take your stand. You don't have to be timid. Stick your hand right out and shout, my friend.
That's the three Andrews sisters at a dance hall where Bud and Lou and Dick Powell go to relax. And they do this wonderful number. And I have to say that this time they actually have Nick Castle doing the choreography. Because there's a lot of other people involved and it's a big number. In fact, all of their numbers are choreographed by Nick Castle. So they're a little bit more ornate. Is that a word? Than they were in Buck Privates.
Yeah, it was so nice to see that they actually had that opportunity. Because, again, you know, we had talked about this in the previous episode as well, how they were pretty much left to their own for choreography during their numbers.
Really from the Ruth Brothers as well.
Well, yes. but especially in this number, "Give Me Some Skin," I just loved the dance break in the middle of it. And they do it so beautifully.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. It's a really good number. And it's another number about white people trying to be as hip as our African-American cousins. if you want to shake my hand like they do it in Harlem, it's just da 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 da. Give me some skin, my friend. Yeah, it's a really great number. Really, really good. I laugh every time they get into a fight at the dance hall and they're taken away to the brig, of course. Mm-hmm. And while they're in jail, Lou gets a telegram saying that Patty Andrews has gone away with a barber, and Lou is just shattered. Like a barber, and, you know, I was hoping I'd be better than a barber. Oh my God. And it turns out that she's going to Hawaii with the Clipper. and I always laugh like an idiot. Yeah. Going to Hawaii with a barber. So they are sent to Hawaii, you know, probably Pearl Harbor. And every you know, sailor has a universal starlet dressed as a Hawaiian hula dancer at their disposal. And there's still Dick Powell still hiding from, you know, Claire Dodd trying to get the picture and all this stuff. Lou is eating dishes. but try that dish. Oh, okay. Oh, so stupid. So they're in Hawaii, but there is another song, and it's on the ship, and Dick Foran gets to sing it.
Yes. I mean,
we forget, you know, we have Dick Powell in the movie, and he's known as a singer, as a crooner, but we forget that Dick Foran had a very good voice, and it was used quite often. So he gets a song here, and it's a really cute nautical comedy song. And my favorite part, of course, is Lou takes the last verse.
A sailor's life for me.
When they make a sailor a CPO, they take out all his brains and inject a gallon of vinegar and mustard in his veins. The chief is great as a Navy man, at least that's what he thinks. But I've seen him trying to swim, and confidentially, he sinks.
Isn't it so great when he sings? I love when Lou gets involved with the music. Because he's got music in him, you know, where Bud didn't really. Bud used to have his voice dubbed, you know, when he'd have to sing. And it never sounded like him. It was their friend Milt Bronson from Burlesque did the singing for Bud, and he sounded nothing like him. I never understood it. But Lou always sang. Lou always had a nice voice. Now, there's a scene. If you read the chapter, I talk about it, between Lou and Claire Dodd, where he first discovers her in the potato locker.
And yes, remember,
there's a tomato in the potato locker. but there's a scene between the two of them where it tells you everything you need to know about working with Abbott and Costello. And I mean, where they're just talking over each other. It's all ad lib. You know, oh, you shouldn't be hiding here. Well, I should be hiding here. No, blah, 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 blah. And at one point, she just looks at him and says, "Thanks, you're cute." And Lou, like this, says, "I only wish that Patty Andrews thought so." So he carried on with the scene, and it was all ad lib. It was just wonderful. Yep. And she handled it like a champ, just like a champ. Yeah. What were we going to say, Jerry? I'm sorry.
I'm good. I threw in the tomato in the potato locker, which is one of my all-time favorite lines from this movie.
I think it's my list. When you bring up in the Navy, that's the line that usually comes up. There's a tomato in the potato locker. and then there's that great joke. Abbott's name is Smokey, and Pomeroy is Costello. And he says, "Smokey, what is that? What is that?" And he goes, "Oh, that's a hull of a ship." And Lou goes, "I know, but what is this?" You know, they got away with that.
Yes.
They also do their famous, whenever they get near a boat, "Where's the stern?" "Oh, it's over the back." "Where's the blah, blah, blah?" "It's over there." "Where's the port?" "It's in the icebox." They've used that joke more times than I can count.
And in this film, Lou does it with Claire Dodd.
With Claire Dodd.
Not with Bud.
And who knew Claire Dodd had these chops? I mean, she was always made the same stupid role in every movie, you know, the threat to the healthy marriage or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Where's the other woman? But she's so cute in this movie, you know.
Yes,
really cute.
Even when she's dressed as a sailor, she's still.
Oh, she's especially cute. Are you kidding? She's like a button. And when he takes the hat off and her hair falls down,
yeah,
really sweet, really, really sweet. Now, I wanted to mention the thing we talked about something I noticed for the first time watching the film. Abbott and Costello had a bit that they did in a couple of films and on their TV show called You're Not Here. Now, yes. What that means is, let's say Abbott would say to Costello, I'll bet you $20 you're not here. And he's like, oh, you're not here. How am I not here? Well, you're not in Baltimore, are you? No. You're not in St. Louis? No. You're not in Pittsburgh? No. Well, if you're not in Baltimore, St. Louis, or Pittsburgh, you must be somewhere else. And if you're somewhere else, you can't be here, right? And then it goes on from there, and eventually yeah. Lou actually turns the tables on Bud. Hey, if I'm not here, I can't take your money, right? So that's like the punchline. But during this one scene, Bud and Lou are talking. They're discussing how worried they are about the fact that there's a woman on board, and they could be court-martialed. Is that what happens in the Navy? You court-martialed? Yeah. So yeah, they could be court-martialed, and they're very worried. And at one point, Lou says very clearly, I wish I weren't here. And Bud turns and says, oh, really? And then they cut. So what I'm suggesting is that they shot that routine and didn't use it. They just cut it out there, but they use it in Rio Rita at MGM shortly afterwards. They bring it back. So that's where they do it for the first time. But that's the kind of stuff I love. That's the, I call that comedy archaeology, you know, you're digging. You're really digging. I love it. Or I should say I dig it. Oh, and by the way, speaking of digging it, I heard from Kevin Brownlow yesterday. Mm-hmm. And luckily they found another clip from the Bud Abbott variety show. I'm telling you, this is really one that will be appreciated by fans of classic television, because the guest stars are just incredible. And I say guest stars because this is the first time he had two. So I'm going to play that clip. Do you mind, Jerry?
Even if I did, you'd do it anyway. So go right ahead.
And might I say that you're absolutely right. So here's a clip. Here's a clip from the Bud Abbott variety show. Here we go. And here he is, ladies and gentlemen, everybody's favorite straight man, Bud Abbott. Yay! Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much. Later in this episode, I'm going to show you how 7 times 13 equals 28, but we'll get to that later. First, let's introduce my special guests. If you're a fan of The Waltons, one of the great shows of all time, you'll recognize these two wonderful people, Ellen Corby and Will Gear. Yay! Thank you, Mr. Abbott. You know, when we're shooting the Walton... Quiet! What are you talking about? Would you talk sense? Mr. Abbott, you shouldn't hit Mr. Quiet, you! Is with you. You're so short, for one thing, and you... No, I wouldn't make fun of the lady like that. Quiet, you! What is with you? Talk sense! That's where it cuts off. But I'm telling you, this is a real find, because Will Gear and Ellen Corby didn't make many appearances away from the show, away from the Waltons. So this is very, very dear to fans. So anyway, if we can move on at this point, I promise. I promise Kevin we would show that. Okay. Someday we're going to get a full episode.
I'll need oxygen if we do.
Oh, God. Okay. Yeah. So, okay. Yes, for you Bud Abbott show fans, that was it. All right. So the next scene is, I call, one of the scenes that killed Lou Costello. I mean the hammock scene. In the hammock.
Yep.
He puts himself through the paces in that one, and he really, really takes some major falls. But some of his best improvising is during that scene.
Yes.
When he treats it like a horse, the hammock. He's trying to sleep in the hammock, you know, on a busy boat, and he's so little, he can't get up into the hammock. And he does a series of incredible falls. And at one point, he actually, you know, puts the blanket on it like he's saddling a horse. He even does the sound. And then he starts playing the ropes like a harp and stuff like that. He's doing real Chaplin-esque stuff. Oh, yeah. You know, it's funny. They show this scene in The World of Abbott and Costello, which was the compilation movie showing scenes from their films. And it's narrated by the comedian Jack E. Leonard. And usually I don't like the narration. It's corny. It gets in the way. But in this case, I think he found the right ending. I think the ending is better than what they actually have in the movie. In the movie, Lou finally gets up there and you know he's going to fall again. And he falls again and they fade out. Jackie Leonard, after Lou falls for the last time, added, "All right, you guys, everybody up." Like he's been trying to sleep all night and then he has to wake up. So I think that's a much better ending for the bit, you know?
Now, you say this is what killed Lou Costello, as you put it. I never got that feeling watching this movie. Mm-hmm. However, when I saw them do this on the Colgate Comedy Hour, like 15 or so years later, that's when I got concerned.
Yes, yes.
He was still taking those same falls after his rheumatic fever and everything else he went through, and he's still doing this. Wow.
I totally get it, and I feel that way. I really do. And yeah, this time, you know, he's young. He hasn't been hit with rheumatic fever yet. So yeah, you're right. There's less to worry about here. But when you do see him later on, you know, and he's sweating and it's not easy to see. He was killing himself, basically.
Yeah.
So then we get to a point in the movie, another scene. I'm sorry if I come off like a pervert, but when Claire Dowd is dressed as the sailor and Dick Foran wants them to wash down and take off their shirts. Mm-hmm. So all the sailors are taking off their shirts and you see a close up of her looking panicked. Uh-oh, what am I going to do? I have these boots that nobody else has. And I'm thinking to myself, take off the shirt. No, never mind. I didn't say it. I didn't think it. I didn't want it. And that's all a lie. So that was a very cute scene, I thought. And that's where Dick Powell actually discovers her. And the ruse is up. Okay. And then we meet a couple of Greek dancers. And they're terrific. The Kondos brothers?
Yes. My gosh. They were incredible.
Aren't they? And I love when Lou shows them the few steps at the beginning and says, "See, guys, that's how you do it." And then they jump in and make a fool out of him. But the Kondos brothers were very popular dancers. They were terrific tap dancers. And one of them, I believe it was Nick. Every Greek family has a Nick, especially if they're, you know, shaving on a rocking boat. But anyway, Nick Kondos, I believe, married Martha Ray. And even after they were divorced, he continued to manage her career and very successfully, I might add. So yeah, he had other talents as well. But that number is just terrific. Their dance number. And it just, you know, I'm sure it fooled a lot of young men at the time to sign up because there was going to be tap dancing and orchestra recitals and Andrew Sisters and all those
and things. Claire Dodd dressed as a sailor. Yeah, all of that
taking
stuff.
Her shirt off. Yeah, all that. I have to tell you, I like the Hullabaloo Owl number. Here's the funny thing. If you're watching the scene, supposedly these Navy men are all sitting in a circle, you know, there's a fire in the middle and there's palm trees in the back and they're, you know, whatever. The thing is, they're in soundstage number 21 and in the background are all these painted palm trees and everything. It's really obvious that they're not in Hawaii.
Yes.
But it doesn't matter because I'll tell you again, I've seen this movie 8,000 times and it's the first time I noticed all of that. It's the first time I saw the backgrounds and stuff. And maybe watching on a Blu-ray makes a difference.
The one thing I noticed this time, I didn't so much catch the background with the painted trees and all, but my theater brain, my stage production brain, immediately noticed that all of the native Hawaiian girls in their grass skirts, the grass skirts were plastic.
Yes.
It had that shimmery look. It was not grass, you know.
No, it wasn't. It's like,
no. Unless they're growing a different crop in Honolulu in those days, you know. They were not grass skirts.
I know they do it in Jamaica, but... But no, they were definitely courtesy of Vera West, the costumer at Universal Studios. Mm-hmm. No, they were definitely starlets, you know, dancing around, maybe the little brown face, you know, as well.
Yep.
But they certainly weren't Hawaiian. Definitely.
It's just an old Hawaiian hula-baloo, wow, where you can do a hula creation with Boogie's incubation that will give you a spin. You want to go and see a hula-baloo, wow, cause when you do, a pretty Hawaiian will start the grass a-flying and you'll have to join in. They sing to the beat of the native drum and a mellow steel guitar. She'll be coming around the old volcano when she comes singing, beat me, daddy, into the bar.
So, okay, now that's Hula Baloo. Actually, a lot of fun. And then they do my second favorite Abbott and Costello bit, and that's 7 times 13 equals 28.
No, come on.
It comes out right all the time.
Well, it shouldn't come out right.
It's got to come out right or I go on the brig. That I know.
Just a minute. Here. We'll add this up. Put down 13 7 times.
Okay.
We'll add it up. That'll
that's
straighten
one,
us out.
Two, three, four, five. Six.
No, wait a minute.
Oh, I forgot dynamite.
Yes.
I don't want to forget dynamite.
No, there's 7 officers. Now we're getting it. Now, you claim all this added up amounts to what?
28.
Give me the chalk.
No, if you take it, the slide will come out right.
Sure, there's something wrong. Yes. 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18, 21.
22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28.
Oh.
I think it's brilliant. And I have to say that I teach a class on film comedy. I teach a class on comedy teams, and I teach a class on Abbott and Costello. And whenever I show this routine, the laughs come exactly in the same places every single time. So what does that tell us? Right?
Yeah.
It's like science. It's like math.
Yep.
And nobody does that bit better than they do. And Shemp is a part of it, too.
Yes.
And I noticed one more thing that I never noticed before after 8,000 times is when in this sketch, Lou is proving to Bud that 7 times 13 equals 28. Now, we know that's not true. We know it's 91. But in Lou's mind, it's 28. And he proves it 3 times by dividing, by multiplying, and then by adding. And it's very funny and very brilliant. I think it's brilliant. Mm-hmm. There are other versions of this routine where they do 5 times 14 or something like that. In fact, Biffle and Schuster did that version of it.
They did.
Right?
They did it well, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, it was fun. It was fun.
My question is, however, they've done this, you know, in at least 2 films and on the TV show. Every time they get to the addition part, are they going to put 13 on the board 7 times and you add it? Mm-hmm. They write 13 on the board, 7, and every single time they do this routine, when they're writing the 13s, the 1 and the 3 get further and further apart as they go down the line. Why? Uh-huh.
I will tell you this. If you tried to do that, what they're doing in that quick a manner, you will do the same thing, I promise you. It just happens naturally, yeah. If you do it quickly, and I tried it. But my favorite is, I think it was in the film television show when he puts the 13s on top of each other in a row. He says it looks like a flock of seagulls flying into a telephone pole. And it does.
Yes.
But here's the part that I never noticed before is that Lou would always write a big 7 to go into a little 2. Right. So he would make the 7 huge and he would write the 2 to be really tiny. And he would say, well, you can't push that big 7 into that little 2. So he turns to Shemp, who plays Dizzy. Yep. And he says, here, Dizzy, you hold on to the 2. And he doesn't hand it to him. He writes it on his hand with a piece of chalk. And I never noticed that before. And he never did it in any other version. And I think it's adorable. You know? On his hand. And it was great. But I love that Shemp is a part of it too. He's really a part of this movie. You know, he plays a real character and all that. So you see Shemp's third banana isms here. He's just terrific. So they do my second favorite, Abbott and Costello routine. Where would you place that? 7 times 13, Jerry?
Yeah, I would have to put it at number 2 for me as well. You know, obviously baseball being number 1.
Definitely. Yeah.
But I would say number 2 for sure.
Yeah, me too.
And this version of it, probably my favorite of all the versions, you know, Little Giant or the TV show or whatever. Yeah.
It's the one I always show to my class and it always works, always. Mm-hmm. Little Giant one, we're going to discuss that when we get to Little Giant, but I don't think it was appropriate in the movie. I think it was a It's kind of like in Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. I always say the movie is great because the monsters are played straight, you know,
yes,
to work against the comedy. But there was that one gag where the monster is afraid of Lou and Dracula,
yes,
has to say, don't worry, he won't harm you or whatever it is. But I never liked that because it took away from the seriousness of the monsters. But, you know, mm-hmm, whatever. I think,
yeah,
this is the same thing. It's kind of the same thing in a way.
Okay.
But anyway, he says another line that I always loved, and I never remember it. When you think about Lou's lines, you know, funny lines, one of the ship's, I guess, underclassmen or whatever, he comes with the captain's breakfast, and Lou has to inspect it. And he opens up, you know, the tray, and he looks at it, and he picks up this really, really burned piece of toast. Do you,
yes,
remember what he says? He goes, what is this, a burnt offering? It always, yep, makes me laugh. It always makes me, what is this, a burnt offering? And he says also, Bud says to him, do you want to go to sick bay? And Lou says, I don't care if it's sick bay or the Dead Sea. I don't, I don't know what to do. Sick bay or Dead Sea. I think that's a great, great line also. Lou knows that the Andrews sisters are coming aboard, especially Patty, who he wants to impress. And Bud, with his prowess, his electronic prowess, arranges for messages to go directly to him and back to Lou in the captain's quarters, which reminds me of another great joke. Ooh, you must be very proud of your quarters, Captain. Oh, money means nothing to me.
Yes.
I love that.
It's those throwaway ones. Those
the throwaways.
They're great.
And there are plenty of them in this movie.
Yes.
But anyway, so he's, it's very complicated. He accidentally gets this sleeping potion that Bud wanted to give to the captain so they could take over his office and fool the Andrews sisters. It turns out that Lou has the Andrews sisters in the office, and he starts doing maneuvers, but he's causing things that are just insane. You know, ships barely miss each other, and all based on his orders, and he doesn't even know what's going on. Anyway,
yeah,
it turns out that it's all a dream and nothing bad has happened. And that was at the request of the United States Navy.
Yep.
The technical people behind said, you can't make a fool of us right now. This is very serious, blah, blah, blah. So it turned out to be a dream sequence. They had to reshoot the scene where he wakes up and finds out he was sleeping. And then it leads to the big finale where Bud gets his baton and starts leading the orchestra. I love that. Bud is actually a solid citizen in this movie. You know, he's not a ne'er-do-well kind of faux villain, you know.
He's actually
a part of society in this. And Lou is on the drums. And actually, Lou was very good at the drums, I might add. You see that in it, not in Ain't Hay.
Coming Around the Mountain.
He does it in Coming Around the Mountain, but he also plays in It Ain't Hay. He's breaking all the dishes.
Trinkets and
It's a nice scene. He's got a great sense of rhythm. So that leads up to Butch and Buddy. I don't get it. Universal, for some reason, signed these two kids, Butch and Buddy. I think Billy Lenhart and Buddy something. I don't know. And one played the bass fiddle and one played the accordion. And they were quite talented that way, but they couldn't act their way out of a paper bag.
No.
And they're just annoying. I always thought that they were nephews of like one of the executives at Universal. And they weren't. They were an actual act. Their most famous, I think, appearance would be in Never Give a Sucker an Even Break with W.C. Fields. They play a part in that. But they're bad in that, too. They didn't last very long. Let's put it that way.
They made the early Our Gang comedies, the earliest incarnation of the kids, made them look like the Barrymores. My gosh, these kids were just...
Yeah,
you're simple line delivery. They couldn't handle. Anyway,
they're standing there, sticking out their tongues at everyone, and trying to be bratty.
Yeah.
they stink. So Butch and Buddy, not a big Butch and Buddy fan, but they set up the ending, the final gag, where they put a giant stick of dynamite under Lou's drum and they light the fuse. And by the time it gets there, Lou looks at us and breaks the fourth wall and says, "I'll bet you thought that was going to go off." And of course, then it explodes and the end. So this is the end, I think, of the first real official Abbott and Costello movie. Mm-hmm. And I'll back this up. Bob Hope, okay, great movie comedian, probably the best solo movie comedian of the 40s and 50s, in my opinion. He took a while to become the Bob Hope we got to know and love in the movies. He started in 1938, and he was more of like a Broadway wise guy character.
Yeah.
You know, he was more of a leading man. They were trying to make him a little more serious, I might say. And he just wasn't the lovable, cowardly, braggadocio, you know, running after women and not really knowing what to do with them once he got there. That was the Bob Hope we love. And he wasn't that until My Favorite Blonde in 1942, four years after his first movie. Mm-hmm. It took Abbott and Costello less time. It took them less than a year, really, to find themselves. But this was the movie, I think, where they actually find themselves. They become the stars, and it continues from here. So, important film. Yeah.
It's a good one.
Oh, it's so funny. Guys, listeners, it is so funny. And it's one of the films where I look at, you know, why aren't they as popular as the Marx Brothers? Why aren't they as popular as the Three Stooges? The movies are terrific, and they're funny, and they're well-made, and they're fast-moving. And if you like the music from that period, which I do, they're also musically wonderful.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's my Abbott and Costello movie commercial, that's about it. It's my birthday.
Yes, it is. And I think as a birthday present for Nick, those of you who have not done so already, go buy yourself a copy of the annotated Abbott and Costello that Mr. Santa Maria has co-authored with Mr. Matthew Conium, also a fine gentleman and a scholar in his own right.
Yes, he is.
It's well worth the price of admission.
Thank you, Jerry. That's very kind of you. And the intro is by John Landis. Not too shabby as far as comedies.
Yeah, even better. In fact, you should buy it just for the intro. Don't just read the rest of it. Just,
use it for, the, you know, if you have a birdcage, that kind of thing.
It is a long book. I mean, there's a lot of pages there you could do that with.
It's almost 500 pages.
What I love about the book, and I'll shamelessly plug this because I get nothing from it, so I'll go ahead and do this. One of the things I love about the book is that not only is, you know, each chapter a deep dive on each film, but then there's one appendix, there's a couple of other, I don't even know what you would call them, charts, graphs,
There's surveys. Everybody's top 10 list.
Yeah.
You know? And we get, you know, we get a lot of people, a lot of good directors and film historians and friends. So we find out which is the most popular Abbott and Costello movie amongst all of these people. Mm-hmm. And let's not tell them what it is. They, you know, you can get the book and
buy the book.
Join in the fun. Yeah. And then I have a chapter about my relationship with Lou Costello, which was a very close one, even though I'd never met the man and he died 3 weeks before I was born. I feel a real kinship with him, and I explain it in this chapter. I also look at the dark side of Lou at this point, because there was a dark side, as it is, you know, with most people. And then Matthew writes a thing about Bud and his early days as a burlesque theater manager and how much trouble he and his family got into by being very Bud Abbott-like. You got 2 tens for 5? You know, so it's... that kind of a thing. So, that's where we're at. And I'm, you know, Jerry, this has been a lot of fun. I look forward to these every month. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Always a lot of fun. Just a plain old good excuse to watch these movies.
It's, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, I agree. And I also love the fact that we're taking notes on them and looking at them even more closely than we ever have. And that's why we're coming up with all this new stuff, all this stuff we never noticed before. Okay, that's it. Abbott and Costello in the Navy with Dick Powell, Dick Foran, and Claire Dodd, not to mention the Andrew sisters. I recommend this one highly. It's one of my top 5 Abbott and Costello movies. Again, they become Abbott and Costello in this film, as we know and love them. So that's about it. Jerry, thank you again for being here. It's such a pleasure to do this with you. And I look forward to the next one, which will be...
As do I.
Hold that ghost. Yes. Next one. Okay. We'll see you guys there. Hopefully Kevin Brownlow will have another clip from the Abbott and Costello Variety Show. And Jerry, I hear the rattling as you shake your head. I hear the rattling. Have a wonderful month, and we will see you next time on Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. Jerry, I got to tell you, I forgot to talk about one section of the film that's very important to me anyway.
Okay.
But it's one of their routines. They repeated it on their film television show. Mm-hmm. I think they might have done it on the Colgate show. I'm not sure. Lou wants to join the Sons of Neptune.
Yeah.
It's a club on the ship. It's a very exclusive club that Shemp runs. So you know how exclusive it must be.
hold on a second there. I'll get you the Sons of Neptune.
All right, anyway, a little Shemp just for you. So here's the deal with the Sons of Neptune. The whole thing is it's a water game. Okay, basically. The guys all put water in their mouths and they stand around Lou, who's in the middle. And Shemp asks him three questions. And the last question always, if you could choose between the air, the land, or the water, what would you want? And Lou says, give me the water. And of course, they all spit water on him. So he decides that he's going to pull it on Bud. And wonders if Bud knows the trick and all this stuff. Apparently, Bud does, because he has a mouthful of water. And Lou keeps spitting out his water. He either laughs and spits it out, or whatever. He gets halfway to Bud and he loses it and he spits it out again. And one of the reasons I love this bit so much is they're having so much fun, and they seem to be laughing, you know, and spitting out the water, and they can't keep a straight face. And you know how it is when you get a mouthful of water, you just want to laugh. And I realized after watching it in other versions, like on their television show and whatever, is that every laugh is planned. Everything was planned. It was not improvised.
Oh, man.
Yeah, yeah. And it works. Believe me, it fooled me.
Yes.
But it was a little bit of a disappointment to find out that it wasn't quite there. It was the same kind of disappointment I felt when I found out that Groucho's You Bet Your Life was written. It was written from top to bottom. And it was his choice either to use the jokes or make up new ones, whatever he wanted to do at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was all written. So right away, it slipped down in my appreciation of Groucho. So this one also, it disappointed me. I thought, wow, how cool. They left it in, you know, they're laughing, they're cracking up. My friends and I used to play a game like that, where you'd have to fill your mouth with water and you had to make them laugh. And there's nothing like laughing with when your mouth is full of water and you're not supposed to, you know, it's like an explosion. Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, you get a lot of that in this bit, and just know that they're taking us in. Let's put it that way. But other than that, that's it. And I'm sorry about this false ending, but I had to include that. And Jerry, thank you for allowing that. I appreciate it.
Not a problem.
All right. Well, again, everybody have a wonderful month, and we'll see you very, very soon.
I bet you thought it was going to go off.